All right, people. Oh, yeah.
Huh?
Oh, you think you're going to get back?
So
today is the last session of this class. Yeah, exactly. So today, my task is to figure out the nature of God and God's relationship to the Jewish people, humanity, and the cosmos, and then we'll have snacks. By the way, does anyone still need a copy of this essay? Now, as always, the summer ends, and I am still left with the mystery of how it is possible that I make 10 more copies than there are students in the class, and I have no copies left. So either people eat them or lose them, or there is divine intervention at a whole other level that I'm aware of.
I think it's related to the issue of the socks and the dryer.
That's actually true. Very good. Okay. Oh.
I'll give it back to you.
Take two of these on.
No, that doesn't help. You lose them together.
You lose them both, right? So then give them to Jacqueline, and don't give them to me, because...
Mine's probably something.
Abby, I want you to stand up and publicly apologize. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Going once, going twice. Okay. All right. Now, I know what's going to happen is I'm going to start, and then in a minute, someone's going to raise their hand. Joe, you are the first person ever to be expelled. Okay, so
here's what I would like to do. First class that I would come from, though.
I could imagine that's true. I want to do a couple of things today. First, I want to spend the bulk of our time sort of talking through the issues raised by the essay Redemption, Prayer, Talmud Torah, the final piece by Rabbi Soloveitchik we're going to talk about, including actually looking at a couple of passages, I hope, somewhat more closely inside. And then I want to, depending on what time it is, maybe talk about a passage from that essay, Majesty and Humility, that was in your previous packet, and then maybe say some closing things about the role of Agadah theology in our religious universe, the religious lives we're trying to build. So the first thing I want to put on the table is a kind of totally open the floor to someone trying to articulate as simply as you can. I left you with a question last time. What is the relationship, according to Soloveitchik, between Geulah and Tefillah, between redemption and prayer, such that halakha requires us to attach Gal Yisrael to the Amidah? If you had to explain in a sentence really what the thesis is, what's the meat of the drasha, what's the heart of the claim that he's making, how would you explain it? And then we can go from there and kind of talk it through more carefully. Eliana?
The only way to attain redemption is through prayer. Should I say more or that?
Okay, you could say one more sentence.
Okay. Because when you pray...
Whenever you want to do that, you just keep saying, that is, you know, namely... Yeah, go ahead.
When you pray, you are acknowledging all that is wrong with the world, and by doing that, moving into the center of history.
Good. Okay. Anybody else want to spin that any differently, add anything to that? Yeah. Okay, interesting. I might want to caveat the ratio of what you said a little bit. I'm not sure it's about your problem versus the world's problem. It's probably your problem in the context. Okay, do you agree with that? Okay, Arya?
Prayer is only possible once three, and the language of that prayer is made possible through the Torah.
Okay. So you're already trying to solve a question that in some ways the essay only gets to later, which is if freedom, if redemption is acquired through speech, this is my formulation, not his, why does the tradition script us? Right? Meaning, if it's the case that the act of speaking is what is redemptive, that is to say, I should say that more carefully, the act of speaking my needs is what's redemptive, then why does a tradition tell me here are the things you should ask for? Shouldn't it actually be a free-form prayer? Right? That's the question I want to get to. It's a very interesting challenge. And I'm going to ask you, Ari, in a little while to flesh out how you think he deals with that question. Okay? But so let's take a step back for a second and ask, what is, in a way, the chidush of this essay? What is the potentially sort of subversive or new or, kind, you know, the sort of spiritual challenge that this essay puts before us that we might not expect, reading of the tradition that might be kind of not what we would intuitively assume? Is there a chiddush to this essay?
His question was very, very challenging to me. This idea that you have to be at the center of history in order to be meaningful and thus in order to be redeemed. That was, like, terrifying. His answer was a lot less challenging in a lot of ways than his question was.
Well, okay, I think, I'll just sort of interject one sentence here. I think the center of history in this essay doesn't mean me to the exclusion of others. Meaning it's not pushing people out of the center so I can be there. I think, I mean, and I'm, as always, I'm happy to be disagreed with about this, but I think that what he means by putting yourself in the center of history is another way of expressing the idea that life is not something that just happens to you, but stepping into the center means exercising agency in the world. Like, not being a passive object, but rather an agency-filled subject. I think that's what he means. I think that's, in a way, all he means. I'm not sure about that, but I think that's all he means. So the language might be jarring because it almost sounds like an elbowing image, right? I want to be at the center. I don't think it means that, but again, we can look at that more closely if you like.
Can you repeat that? Can you just repeat that, what you said? What's his problem in the beginning? Not his problem, but what is he?
Look, I think, so in a way, this is getting inside my head about why I was reading this essay with you guys now, which is that I think this essay is yet another way in which he is thinking about the question, how do I go from object to subject? How do I become someone who's not only acted upon by the world, but also someone who acts in the world? In other words, and what's interesting about this is, I think many people who talk about the language of creativity would not be inclined to say, oh, and a very interesting form of creativity is the act of prayer, right? Or many, let's put it this way, many sort of more secular understandings about creativity would look at it and say, prayer, prayer is all about quietism, passivity, right? And he's actually saying something really profound here, which is, agree with it, buy it or not, he's making the claim that the act of prayer is an act of self-redemption, not even just self-creation, but self-redemption, right? Something happens to me in the act of speaking my needs that I am already redeemed once I've spoken, right? That's a dramatic claim. Now that I just said that, again, what's the chidush? What is the chidush of this essay, ultimately? It's very interesting. I have the same three people wanting to talk there. Yeah. Oh, again, I can't see. Oh, Tony, great, I can't see you.
That the point is ultimately and essentially individual. It's all about self-expression, like manifesting yourself in the world, as opposed to, like, you know, like many other views of what Judaism is about, which are not individual.
Do you think that he would, that description you just made of him would resonate with him? Would he regard that as a fair characterization of what he's doing here?
Yeah, because he's talking about the, like, redemption prayer too is a basic experiential category in Judaism. I mean, he's talking about the experiential, the phenomenological, the blah, blah, blah. So, like,
okay.
All about...
Okay, so does anyone disagree with the way Choni just said that? I'm actually curious to just get... Yeah, Choni just said, you'll tell me, Choni, if this is a fair characterization, that one of the things that's maybe innovative or surprising about this essay is how individual the focus is. It's about the redemption of the individual, and it's not focused so much on broader concerns. It's a very individualistic portrayal. Now, is that accurate according to other people? Is that fair? That is fair. You think, in other words, it's fair. You think Soloveitchik would think that's an apt characterization of what he's saying? You can say yes. I just want to. I think that there are other ways to read this. I want to just get them all on the table. Yeah. Hurry up.
I have a vague feeling. I'm only saying it because no one else is talking. But it's that, like, that's not the case. But, like, yeah, he's talking about, like, the experience of an individual, but he's not being individualistic. Like, it's not like he thinks that only the experience of an individual matters. Like, he probably thinks that you should have prayers that are concerned with others, you know? Like, yes, he's focused on the experience of the individual, but that doesn't make him, like, making an individualistic view. Like,
okay, good. All right. Choni, you want to respond again, and then Stephen? And we'll go around that way. Yeah.
Well, okay, so I want to, like a serious argument against me is that he's using the, like, Exodus from Egypt as, like, a main thing, and how the people of Israel found their voice with Moshe. But still, I think that it's only the people of Israel as one unitary being, and not the people of Israel as, like, a individuals coming together in community.
Okay. Stephen, you want to say something about this?
Oh, just to respond to the question you were asking earlier, is this individual or community focused? In the second line of point one, it says redemption involves a movement by an individual or a community. From the periphery of issue to its center. So clearly, he doesn't much care which way we take it. He wants the most inclusive sense. I would, however, so that's on the sense of maybe Honi's not quite right. But I also think that Honey's quite right in that most of his focus is the individual here. And that's an interesting shift, I think, throughout the essay, where redemption becomes a personal thing that individuals achieve through prayer. But of course, the project for Soloveitchik is also much bigger. It's communal.
Okay, so let me sort of interject one sentence here, and then I'll take the rest of the comments on this side. I think that, Honey, your comment is both right and incomplete, right? It's right in the sense that it is certainly the case that this essay puts the center of gravity on Geulat HaYachid, right? The redemption of the individual, which is itself not an unprecedented move, especially when the history of Kabbalah has all kinds of preoccupation with Geulat HaYachid, but it is not the sort of most mainstream, usual understanding of the category of Geulah. In fact, you know, in some very cardboard constructions of Judaism versus Christianity, people are always inclined to say, right, Christianity is interested in the redemption of the individual soul, and Judaism is interested in the redemption of the world, right? That incredibly sort of simplistic formulation is based on something, even though it's simplistic. And this essay shifts the center of gravity, as Choni says, to Geulat HaYachid. And not only Geulat HaYachid, but it actually says that the Geulah that takes place is internal. Right? Because my speaking my need doesn't mean that my political situation is changed. It doesn't mean that my disease goes away. It doesn't mean that the problems of my life are gone. It means that through the act of speaking, that is already redemptive and transformative. Okay? So I think on that level, you're right. Where I think it just needs to be complicated a little bit is, if you keep reading this essay, he will then do something, and he does it very subtly, and it takes us to Arye's comment from the beginning. And that is to say that one of the problems of life, and I think he would say modern life in particular, is that we are totally convinced of false needs. We think we need things that are actually not the things we need. This is something that I've mentioned in passing in this class, right? Is this whole kind of motif in 20th century spiritual writings, Jewish and Christian, of the true and false self, right? Stripping away the true self so that you recover the false self, which has, let's call them actual needs, as opposed to the need Soloveitchik himself says generated by advertising, right? The need, so I need to have this car, I need to have this size house, I need to have, you know, I need, right? And for him, and this is Honi where I think this is like very complex, this move, is the work of liturgy, he thinks, is precisely in reorienting our list of needs. Right? The work of liturgy, according to Soloveitchik, again, you can endorse this or not, but the work that he thinks liturgy does, sort of to us, is remind us of what, this is loaded language, our most authentic self should want. Right? Because it doesn't allow us to say, oh God, you know, please give me the next level up of car, right? Or please, you know, get me a parking spot on the Upper West Side. It actually says things like, you know, heal Jerusalem, bring redemption to the world, cure illness. It orients me to concerns that are authentic and also communal and global, right? And that's where I think it gets complicated, because in other words, the redeemed individual, as Soloveitchik imagines him or her, is not just praying for him or herself. He or she is actually, I think, if I'm reading him correctly, is articulating his own individual need for things that go beyond me. So it's individual, but it radically opens what's meant by an individual. Because an individual, this, by the way, this kind of understanding is very close to what Heschel talks about when he talks about, you know, the needs of others become my own needs. I need someone to have food as much as they need it. That's a kind of, you know, a spiritual place of, you know, serious achievement, where other people's hungers are my needs. So I think it is individual, but it's not. And it's very tempting. I know, like, when I read this essay for the first time years ago, even when I first taught it, I was like, oh, this is this, like, radical individualism piece, right? This is, like, amazingly sort of subversive, and in a way, it's even self-centered. And then I sort of started realizing, if you keep reading, the way he uses liturgy is precisely to undermine the temptation to read it that way. And so let me say one other way, and then I'll keep taking comments. In other words, I don't think that this essay is, oh, on the one hand we have an existentialist, and on the other hand we have a traditional thinker, and so in his clunky, awkward way he merges them. I think he actually thinks that a religiously serious existentialism needs something fixed and communal to it, lest it just become narcissistic. Right? In other words, if I don't learn to pray in the plural, then in the end, that can't be redeemed, that's just totally self-preoccupied. And there's something, to use his language, deeply enslaved about that. There's something deeply not free about a universe in which the only thing I care about is me. Okay, there's a lot more to say about that, but let's take some more comments on what I just said. Maybe that helps clarify some of what's going on here. John, and I want to go this way. Yeah.
I thought one of the other major kiddushim in this essay was the equating of prayer and Talmud Torah. Even though there are moments in tefillah that are Talmud Torah, equating the two activities in some way seems to be a major kiddush, and I don't know how that relates to his existential piece, but I thought it was really a little, one, it's sort of expected of a brisker Talmud scholar, but it's also really fascinating to see prayer and Talmud Torah as being kind of equated experiences of redemption.
Okay. That, by the way, also connects to our reading of Halachic Man, because the act of being Mechadesh is the act of being mitgael in some way, if that's nigaal.
Yeah.
Good. Other, Bria?
It's just interesting because I feel like a lot of similar ideas to this have come up for me in texts from like very different traditions, in terms of like self-transcendence and like a more deeply rooted self versus the ego. But Hume does very much talk about the I and this intellectual I, and which is like often, I guess I haven't seen that
Yeah, it's a more hyper-intellectual version of a preoccupation with self-transcendence. And some might even critique that and suggest that there's a way in which being totally focused on the intellect at times cuts against a certain kind of self-transcendence. He clearly doesn't think that, right? And it's a complicated thing in reading Soloveitchik, because on the one hand, he'll say things like, oh, you know, the height of halachic man's creativity is intellectual. And at the same time, as you read more and more of his essays, you realize that, like, there's really nobody in 20th century Jewish life who writes in such dramatic first-person terms about the sheer emotionality of the religious life, right? This is not some kind of dry, you know, caricatured, misnagdic yeshiva type, right? Which is a caricature anyway, But he's not that by any stretch. I mean, in fact, one of the things that's very unusual about him, and it's kind of odd coming from someone from that world, is how totally, wildly expressive he is in public ways about his own inner life. Right? Like, he has none of that reticence that you associate with maybe Jewish culture more broadly, and certainly the Jewish culture he emerges from. He is very much a machadesh in that regard. As I've said to you many times, you know, it takes a certain type of essay, a certain type of person, to write a significant work of Jewish thought, which begins basically by saying, I am lonely. Right? There's a certain kind of, you know, audacity to that. Yeah, anyway. Okay, go ahead.
This is not a philosophical comment. It's completely anecdotal. When I was a kid and the state of medicine was a lot less advanced than it is now, I would pray for certain people to be cured than they were. When I have prayed for my own needs and even my own wants, I have had a higher success rate than, you know, I pray every day for peace on earth. I ain't going to see it. I pray for the end of poverty. I pray for the end of hunger. I ain't going to see it. When I pray for things personally, I have a much higher chance of seeing it realized in my lifetime.
What's the therefore in that sentence?
When I was a kid, it meant my prayers weren't being answered. At this point, it's that it's great if I pray beyond myself for bigger things, but I have to watch my expectations.
Okay, great. So, Hillary, you just gave us the perfect window into what I think is the kind of the second dimension of Chiddush in this essay that is in a way so obvious that it's easy to miss it. If Soloveitchik's claim is that the act of speaking is redemptive, then in the logic of this essay, whether and in what way God responds to my prayer has been rendered totally immaterial. It doesn't matter. Because instead of redemption being I pray to God and express my needs, and then maybe God intervenes and gives me what I want, in this construction of the act of prayer, the very act of praying is what is redemptive. Now, if you want to be cynical about it, you say God has been let off the hook in dramatic ways in this essay. If you want to be, you know, more generous about it, you say that the center of gravity, right, in a kind of phenomenology of prayer, in a way of imagining the experience of the person in prayer, has been shifted away from sort of asking and waiting to the transformative act of asking itself. Right? That's the move he makes. And that can be understood as quite radical. And actually, I think it's important to note that among the people who do this in modern times are people who we might call robustly theistic thinkers, meaning people who really, like, believe in God, right? And yet, right, the move they make is very often about not putting the attention on what will God do if I pray, but rather what happens to me in the act of praying. Now, that is not to say that Soloveitchik doesn't think that there's a God who might sometimes intervene. But it does mean that that's no longer the center of attention. This is akin, in a way, I think I mentioned this at some point, when Heschel writes in the preface to Man's Quest for God, prayer may not save us, but prayer will make us worthy of being saved. Right? Prayer may not save us, but prayer will make us worthy of being saved is a way of saying, I'm not talking right now about what God's going to do. I'm talking about what happens to me in the act of opening myself to God. So that's a huge kind of reorientation in the act of prayer. Okay, yeah. Bria and then Philip.
But then is it really opening yourself up to God or just to yourself?
So I have two questions for you. Number one, how do you think Soloveitchik would answer that? Number two, how do you think you would answer that? Not to put you too much on the spot, but, I mean, it's a great question.
It's a great question. So let's sort of think that out for a second. If it's true, this is like this is where, you know, the bottom threatens to fall out of this argument. If it's true that the redemption takes place in the act of my speaking, well, then why do I have to be speaking to an other or even a divine other? So let's play that out. No, you don't want to answer.
So that we respect what the community
is doing, is that there is some sort of information on the law. And you may need something, but I think you would say that God is the tremendous leader. And it's still important.
So why is it important? Let's just sort of put this in a very crude way. Why is it important that I pray to God as opposed to talk to my therapist? What is different for Soloveitchik about prayer as opposed to therapy?
It's free.
It's free.
It's
free. You might say the cost of praying authentically is you have to totally transform your life, so I'm not sure it's actually free. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think it relates to what you were saying about his sense of the eye. It also, his sense of language is pretty counterintuitive. Like, you would have thought that someone talking about redeeming yourself through language might have been interested in individuals finding their own voice in a given situation. But what's meant by talking, at least at the basic level, I think, is saying the words of the liturgy. So actually, what speech is, when you said opening yourself up to God, I don't think that's just opening yourself up, like being open to stuff out there in the world. It's saying God's words, which were designed perfectly to like capture your existential state and tell you who you are. So I think actually it's different to therapy, because in therapy I say whatever comes into my mind, probably completely getting my needs wrong. But in prayer,
So is that Soloveitchik or are you talking? Or both?
I think that's Soloveitchik. Well, I was obviously talking.
I was actually wondering for a minute. Soloveitchik with that very tall grown up. Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. You know, because I could imagine, Benji, as you're talking, I could imagine someone here saying either A, look, I buy the premise, which is why I don't think the excessive focus on liturgy makes sense, or I buy the premise that we need to recover the true self rather than instead of the false self, and that's why I think liturgy is so important, without necessarily buying the speech's inherently redemptive piece. I think what's interesting is holding both of those things at the same time, which for him are intrinsically linked, because that's the self we want to emerge. But, okay, Philip, I'm sorry.
What I'm so really curious about is his use of history. And really where he draws, like, the example he uses to say, this is how it happened, is the Exodus from Egypt.
Right.
In which we were physically redeemed as slaves, and, like, he talked about how this process of, and God heard our voice, and that was what allowed us to begin this process. And I'm curious the way that it's now focused on this individual spiritual redemption from, like, I guess, the plagues and modern modernity. But what does he then say kind of in the sort of process that I continue now? Like, is he, so it's like to simply say with whatever slavery there is in the world now, for them to simply say their needs would not be done through.
Good. Okay, so I want to take your question and ask for someone who finds this essay in a way outrageous in the following way. Okay? Wait a second. Like, this is the perfect prescription to give up on actually caring about changing people's political circumstances, on actually curing. If redemption is just the act of speaking from the midst of pain and need, haven't you fundamentally taken all of the force out of what redemption has meant in the history of Jewish thought? I mean, it's very nice to be an existentialist, but haven't you fundamentally, like, stripped the category of its meaning? So what would you say, what would you either articulate a version of that, or how do you think he would respond to that? Like, why isn't this, why can't one say, by the way, this is not a question for which I'm expecting, like, a clear answer, but why can't one say, okay, I understand you're in bad political circumstances, but you seem to really have not lost your voice and you are able to articulate your predicament to God, so you are free in the ways that matter. What, how would he think about that? Or how should we think about that in light of reading it? Zach?
Well, we read in Halakha that he thinks that kind of like maybe the or one of the fundamental human projects is to say, to have an understanding of what God does or kind of what God brings to the world, and then to participate in the realization of that ideal. So if you're only, and maybe like create, if that's like part of what being creative is. And so if you're only saying it, but then not actually creatively pursuing that ideal, you're fundamentally not doing what he advocates for on like a very broad basis. And I also just think like beyond that, when you pray, but then like actively, I think there's a difference between praying and knowing that what you're praying for might not come versus praying and like knowing that you're not going to pursue that which you're praying for. That like your words are empty words versus my words might not come to fruition.
Okay, good. Anybody want to add to that or disagree with it or wait a minute? Abby? No, well, I don't know. I have a feeling that he would say something just like that. And I think that that's what he thinks goes on in the Yitzhak Mitzrayim story. And this is actually, there's a Sfas Emes that says something very close to this, which is it's only when Bnei Yisrael are willing, I mean, you can argue this is a pshat of Shmot, but it's only when Bnei Yisrael are actually willing to articulate that the current situation is unacceptable to them, that the possibility of freedom emerges, right? That's essentially what you're saying, right? Is that actually, in other words, that he wouldn't be saying, okay, you're redeemed in the sense that, okay, ball game over, but you're redeemed in an existential sense, and although that's not the focus of this essay, the kind of maybe natural, logical, I don't know exactly what words you use there, this, some kind of consequence of that redemption is leaving. Let me give you, actually, here's a very concrete example. If you ever read the autobiography or autobiographies of Frederick Douglass, right? So it's very interesting what happens in those biographies, right? Which is, and it's related in a way, which is that the moment Frederick Douglass learns to read, he's basically already free, right? And then the kind of playing out of his life story as he tells it is, okay, how do I actualize this truth that has already happened? Right, the moment he says, in you know, one of the famous lines in the narrative of A Life of a Slave, he says, you have seen how a man was made a slave, now you shall see how a slave was made a man. The moment he says that, he's already not a slave. Not because, or maybe I should say it better, Abby, in Europe, not only because he has spoken his freedom, but also because once he said that, he's almost sort of ineluctably driven to get out. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is that a fair example of what you're just sort of suggesting?
Yeah, the difference between what you're saying and what I meant to say is that you have a causal piece from that you have to reach this condition of existential freedom to get any other kinds of freedom done. And I don't know that I'm married to that, but like I can live with that.
Well, I'm not sure I'm married to that either. I'm wondering whether he's married to it.
Yeah.
Meaning he...
Okay.
And I'm not sure, because this essay doesn't, you know, exactly. This is not his concern here. But it's hard for me to believe that all he wants to do is fundamentally overturn and transform the category of geula such that other kinds of freedom are no longer interesting to him. It's more likely to me that he wants to first psychologize, internalize. I mean, this is in a way what you'd expect from a Hasidic Rebbe. Right, this kind of essay, which is, oh, what are we talking about? We're talking about the exile of an individual soul and its ability to achieve freedom, and that's the project. But I don't think that that's the only project, is the point. Okay, Eddie, you want to say something?
Right, so maybe another way of saying this is, I don't think that we should read this essay as, like, morally callous, such that he's saying, oh, well, there's political slavery, and then there's the slavery of my being, you know, living on the Upper West Side and not being in touch with my needs. And I don't think he's equating those things in a facile way. I think he's talking about slavery comes in all kinds of sort of iterations and versions, right? Which is a very different claim. And it's all, the danger of reading an essay by someone is that it raises hundreds of questions that would require, you know, a 500-page a theology of freedom in the Jewish imagination, which is not what this is. This is kind of a drusha about a text about what is redemptive about the act of tefillah, right? And it's important not to, in a sense, think that you have a window into a kind of a systematic theology here. As I said, you know, at the very beginning of the summer, that's never what you have with Soloveitchik. I don't think you have that in Halachic Man, let alone, which might look like that, let alone in an essay like this, which is, in the end, a kind of philosophical drusha. That's what this is. Yeah, Avi?
I'm using the slave as the metaphor for this. He has this one line that I find extremely problematic, both as the metaphor and as the actual.
Okay, what page are you on?
On 56.
Okay.
Under number 3. Mm-hmm. It says here in the bottom, the slave has neither a story nor a curious audience. The fact that he seems to think like a slave has no until this moment, I think it's problematic both in terms of talking about actual slavery and in terms of his metaphor that until you have this moment, like until you have that Frederick Douglass learning, until you learn to read, you have no thoughts.
Right.
I think it's problematic on both planes.
So what do you think he would say to that? How do you think?
I'm going to argue a little bit.
Arya, do you want to respond to that?
Imagine him saying that. The story can just mean like the first out of the name for Adam and slave. It doesn't have to mean that he means in the sense that it's not until you recognize the pain and you're able to express that in any way. And he said like this slave that he's talking about is one that like is just so unaware of its own expression that they're totally lost. As he says at the end, you have to become independent and then lose yourself in God again.
I guess I think it would be less troubling if he said there's a type of slave that's in this situation. It feels to me like he's imposing on all slaves an inability to. Just because he's equating not having a story, not having a curious audience with not having a story.
Yeah, I think that for him, obviously, it's interesting, because the critique is very interesting. I have a feeling that one of the directions he might go with this is to say that for him, having a story is a social act, not an internal act. Having a story means having an ability to bring another into my experience. And what someone who does not yet have speech is unable to do is to create the bridge between two human beings over the suffering that one of them is enduring. That's, I think, what he means by not having a story. Not having a story means, I think, just based on how he tends to use this kind of language, means not being able to get out of my totally enclosed circle of suffering. I think, but I'm not sure about this. It's a very interesting question. Yeah, Arya?
Well, the slave here isn't like a slave in chains. It's the metaphysical.
But we started with the metaphor.
I know, but I think here he's talking specifically about the slave that's going to be redeemed in prayer.
Okay.
And that there are separate things. There's the story and then there's the audience. And then you can have a story before you have an audience.
Right. Okay, so that would be interesting to think about, whether story and audience come to be at the same moment.
Well, no, they don't, because I think that's what he says, is that the... Unless you think like Moshe is the first audience, but I don't think so. He says like once Moshe's on this, I mean that's the Zohar is, Moshe gives them the noise.
Right.
And then the audience is God giving them words. So it's two stages. That's at least how I read it.
To think about that more. It's interesting. I'm not sure. I'm not, yeah. It might be right. It still strikes me somehow that story is a social category. Maybe I'm not right about that. I would think about that sentence more. I'm not sure. I mean, your rejoinder is fair, but I'm not sure. Certainly with the mashal, it works. Whether it works with the nishal completely, I'm not sure. No,
I don't know.
I'm not sure. It's in, yeah, okay. Yeah, Joe.
I mean, I was bothered by, and continue to be bothered by, Avi's critique, or a critique that I had similarly. And one way that I got at it that was a little bit helpful was thinking about it in terms of pedagogy of the oppressed or consciousness raising, the ways in which, like, realizing that there's some kind of process of storytelling whereby one realizes one is enslaved or there's another possibility, and that is kind of all on the ground all the time in political movements talking about the other.
Yeah, I think that that's continuous in a way for him with, and this is what I was trying to get at by talking about a social act of story, it is that for him, so much of where life begins to be sort of human, let alone redeemed, is in the moment of the possibility of creating community between two or more people, that somehow until that moment, it doesn't make sense to talk about. I'm not saying this well. I'm a little stuck on how to say this. Your critique is, I think, really interesting. It's just that I think for him, it's what he means by anonymity, right? Anonymity means there's actually nobody else who cares about my suffering but me, and redemption is the overcoming of anonymity, which is only accomplished through things by speech. Now, that may also have dramatic political consequences, because once you and I talk to each other about our suffering, we may decide to act. But I think he thinks the first step of that redemption is the formation of an interpersonal bond. I mean, that's how he thinks the story of Adam and Eve makes sense, as a story about, you know, overcoming the abyss of loneliness that every human being finds themselves in, unless and until they're able to sort of speak across that abyss. I don't know. Does that make sense to you? Does that sound like it's a fair... let's get two things. It's either, is it A, a fair characterization of how he might respond, and B, do we find it fully persuasive? I think it's A. B, I think, is more open to talking about, although, you know, there's a way in which, in this sense, he's very much in the tradition of what, you know, philosophers or historians of philosophy call the whole philosophy of sort of the dialogical tradition, right? The whole notion that humanity is realized and achieved in the moment of creating some kind of interpersonal space, right? The most famous Jewish version of that is obviously Buber. But in that sense, he's aspiring to something similar. Anonymity means nobody knows who I am, nobody cares. Meaning, it's easy to misread anonymity here to think, oh, the only way I'm redeemed is if I'm someone who, like, people will read about 100 years from now. I don't think that's what he means at all. Anonymity can be overcome in a conversation alone with one other person. Because as long as there's another person who hears who I am, I'm no longer anonymous. I think that's his project. And there, the Yudlam Peretz story helps and doesn't help. The Bunch of Schweig thing. Okay. I want to just ask one last question about this. Which is, do people... When you hear the sentence, when he says one can be fully free in the midst of political and economic oppression, is that sentence, in the end, helpful, motivating, inspiring, or is that sentence... I mean, we've been talking about this in a way, but does that sentence lead to a kind of quiescence?
I think it's like the opposite. Because I think that what he's talking about is, like, what human beings have over, like, animals. Like, what he's talking about is, like, what makes us fundamentally human, which is, like, an ability to, like, appreciate our situation and, like, communicate it. And so I think that, like, and it sort of argues against the conception of, like, slaves as having, like, somehow, like, a different level of soul or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's saying, like, people who are in bad situations are just the same as the rest of us, and I think it's actually more motivating to, like,
okay,
help.
Okay, you know, you might even formulate this in a slightly different way, which is, without the capacity for speech, I don't mean this in some, like, pedestrian way, without the capacity for speech, would it be possible for a movement for liberation to even emerge? Right? Without the ability of people to share their experience of suffering, is it possible for the world in any way to move?
which I think is part of what he's doing here. Although, again, to go back to something that Phil said before, that's not where the center of gravity in this essay is. The center of gravity in this essay is on the transformative power of speech. The transformative power of prayer. But the transformative power of prayer is made possible by the transformative power of speech, which is on some level prior. Right? That is, when Targum Yonatan, right, explains that a human being is nefesh memalila, what it means to be a person is to be a speaking being, I think that's what he's sort of interested in here. And that's prior to prayer. Okay, so I wanted to say actually one last thing here about this essay, and maybe we'll leave this essay with this, which is that for me anyway, and this is something I alluded to in the response I wrote to Rav Schechter a few months ago about women as rabbis, it seems to me that this essay, although this is not how Soloveitchik meant it, is an incredible theological argument for a religious feminism. Meaning, this essay is about the claim that redemption takes place through the act of speaking, and if we understand ways in which the tradition has, on the one hand, said in the past, or the tradition has been interpreted as saying, on the one hand, a human being is nefesh memalula, is a speaking being, and on the other hand, some of you should be quiet. There's a way in which the full realization of what it means to be a nefesh memalula in the world, what it means to be a speaking being, is for those who have been silent to acquire voice. Not to be given voice, but to speak. Right? This is not about the master giving the slave the right to speak. This is about the slave, as it were, speaking. The agency has to lie with the speaker, not with the bestower of the right to speech. Just seems to me this is like an incredible language in that way about what it means to talk about human beings moving to being history-making entities, to use that language, to being subjects rather than objects. And in many ways, it seems to me that's a theological basis. When people talk about, which I think is, you know, often reflexive, quite literally, is, oh, you know, that project is fundamentally an importation to Judaism of something outside, which I'm not sure that most of the history of Judaism isn't about precisely that, but okay. The notion that actually it can be, it doesn't have to be, but it can be a manifestation of some of the deepest sort of claims of Judaism's, now to say it's potentially theological anthropology, that is, the claims of how Judaism imagines what a human being is, right, lead almost ineluctably to the process of women assuming greater voice. That's true about tefillah, it's true about marriage and divorce, it's true about ultimately eidut, it's true in all kinds of ways. But I think it's actually like a really interesting and important theological way for thinking about why some of those things are not just kind of counter to religious impulse, but are actually the playing out of some really profound religious and theological impulses. And just to be clear, right, lest I be yet again attacked for this, I am not suggesting Soloveitchik would want to be used in this way. I'm suggesting that the theological basis for this argument is right there to be picked. And by the way, when it came to the Beit Midrash, he might well have actually enjoyed being used in particular this way. What would have made him nervous is that he couldn't stop it there, which is, I think, in many ways what many people in the non-egalitarian world have struggled with, is that they thought they could sort of, let's say, give women access to voice and say, but okay, but in advance, I'm drawing the boundary of where that's going to happen. And that didn't work. I can give you many, you know, very concrete examples of this. But, okay, there's, yeah, one comment and then I want to just sort of move to the end.
Okay, even though this last comment on feminism is fascinating, I want to go back a step. I see interviews on TV with Palestinians who tell the story of how beautiful it was when they lived in Haifa, and how the fruit was the best fruit in the world, and the trees were the most beautiful trees in the world, and they are telling a story. And by telling the story, they are refusing to live in the present, they are refusing to compromise and make peace, because they are telling this story. And does that make them redeemed? Does that make them free? Or does that keep them in shame?
Okay, so... I have no idea how I'm supposed to respond to that in the sort of 3 minutes that I plan to respond to that. Look, here's what I'll say as a beginning to that. I think that where Buber is a really interesting, I don't want to say corrective, because I'm not sure Soloveitchik would disagree on a theoretical point, but let's say where Buber is an important caveat to this discourse is that in addition to becoming a speaking being, one also has an obligation at the same time to become a listening being, especially when, in Soloveitchik's language, what speech makes possible is communion, right? Becoming a communing being. You can't become a communing being if you only tell your story. Now, that's true about every interpersonal conflict, let alone interpeople conflict, and it's always true about both sides of that encounter, right? In other words, the notion of speaking without being open to the possibility of being spoken to is in some ways like the ultimate non-relational act. And I think that the logic of this essay, if not the explicit formulation of it, is that if what you're trying to establish through speech is communion with another, speech and listening have to be totally intertwined. Otherwise, what you've established is literally a captive audience and not, right, an other. That, by the way, is also true about Jews telling their story, right? I mean, just to be explicit about that. It's true about, and whether you think that Buber's own political proclivities about sort of what Zionism should look like were naive, problematic, compelling, whatever you have to think about Buber, that claim about how interpersonal speech works, I think, is like such a basic shared human intuition that the challenge is to actually wonder whether and how it can be moved into a political sphere. Right? Because Buber's claim, which was, I think, kind of interesting, like, make of it what you want, was, it can't be the case that we have this vision of what interpersonal encounter looks like, and then we say, yeah, but politics is a different business. In politics, none of this has any application. Then basically, then you're writing off politics as fundamentally inhuman and unredeemable, which you might decide to do, but at great cost religiously if you make that decision. All right, let me...
Thank you.
Hana, only because you haven't spoken, I'm going to let you speak.
Thank you.
You don't have to wait for me to let you speak. You should just speak. Yeah?
Okay. To sort of go back, I'm really stuck on something that he says.
Great.
There's one spot where he really just articulated this on page 66. Okay? Just the whole concept that prayer must arise from suffering.
Right.
God needs neither thanks nor hymns. Like, is that really the only way to be redeemed? What if someone already goes through the suffering and is redeemed, and then what? Like,
yeah. So good. So this is you know. Okay. So I want to say two quick things about this. First of all,
especially because he does not believe in changing the liturgy, which includes lots of thanks.
Great. So first of all, I will say that Soloveitchik has at times, let's say, a temptation to the hyperbolic mode, right? You know, he'll make these incredibly dramatic statements, you know, like, this can only be achieved through prayer. Okay, you might consider making an argument for that, right? And it's a very dramatic formulation. Now, in terms of your question, I think I might have talked about this in the context of Heschel, but maybe not so
indulge me for 2 minutes because it's useful for thinking about. Heschel makes the case extremely strongly that the essence of tefillah is praise. Right? So we talked about this, right? So much so that you almost have the sense that Heschel is at times a little embarrassed by bakasha. Hence, that thing I mentioned to you, or I forget, maybe I even gave it to you to read. Where he says, you know, there's that moment when you're asking for health, where you're actually not concerned about your health, but about talking about God as healer, right? It's actually in the Refa'inu, it's calling God Rofe is the moment of real tefillah. Now, I think it's probably fair to say that both of these figures have adopted sort of semi-absolutist formulations, right? And that actually prayer emerges from lots of different human circumstances, and we can call it authentic prayer emerging from, I mean, like, what about gratitude, right? I mean, what about, like, thank you, God? That's somehow not the deepest form of prayer. It's an odd claim, right, that there's one thing that is, like, this is what prayer really is. You know, in general, with almost any relational thing, when you say this is what it is, you are likely oversimplifying dramatically. Now, just to be clear for a second, he does this a lot, and this is just sort of an interesting thing to think about. The reason why I think Heschel does not like putting our attention on bakasha is because he thinks that the goal is self-transcendence as he understands it, and as long as I'm still making bakashot, I'm saying me, me, me. I have a feeling that Soloveitchik's response to that would be, the moment I'm making bakashot, even if they're about me, I'm expressing my own vulnerability and lack of power, which is also a form of self-transcendence. Now, I'm not asking you to take sides right now, but in other words, I just want to make clear, it's not that Soloveitchik is sort of, oh, I don't care about self-transcendence, I just want to talk about what I need. I actually think that there's a way in which, and also the language of the plural that we talked about in response to Choni's comment. I mean, I think he thinks he's doing a different kind of self-transcendence, and I think he would argue, look, you know what, Professor Heschel? The fact is, at the center of the Amidah is bakashot. So, I'm just interpreting the liturgy, what about you? Now, I think Heschel might say it, right, but have you heard of the Psalms we spend lots of time saying before? Right, they're not, oh God, I'm sick. They're actually, thank you for the glory of this universe. They're not only that, I understand, but so, there's an interesting conversation to be had there, but they're both oversimplifying to make a point. Do you want to respond?
Yeah, I just think that it's important to note that focusing on bakasha really does take the, like, God out of the limelight. And if he, without, like, sort of saying, like, okay, bakasha is the essence, but there's also thanks and like, praise, he's sort of leaving room for someone to kind of take God out of the picture as he sees it and sort of just be surrendering to another. Whereas in Heschel's, like, view, it's impossible to do that, really. So
yeah, I mean, you know, at the risk of saying something totally reductive, which, you know, I hate more than anything, I just want to point out that there's a way in which some of what you're picking up on here is a little bit of a temperamental difference between them, which is that ultimately, you know, a theologian who begins his whole worldview with a portrayal of wonder and the elusiveness of all reality to the transcendent God and the sense that God's presence is everywhere permeating the universe may begin with bakasha more than someone who is through and through an existentialist who basically begins his most interesting theological work by saying, I am lonely. Right? In other words, it's a very different term. I mean, the universe Heschel inhabits is totally filled with the presence of God. The universe Soloveitchik inhabits is one in which his fundamental condition is of being thrown in the world and looking desperately for a lifeboat to God. Right? So it's both temperament, but also like a different place of where does a connection to God begin. And you learn a lot about a person, ultimately, by that. Right? You know, Heschel, I think, would not really recognize, you know, the mode that would say, oh, we find ourselves in a world with no connection to God at all. I think he would say, well, then wake up. Right? Okay. Soloveitchik, you might say, and I mean this quite seriously, if playfully, if that makes any sense, Soloveitchik is a much more modern Protestant thinker, and Heschel is much more of a Catholic, right? If you think about Protestantism as beginning with a world, right, where God has been sort of kicked upstairs, and the links between God and humanity are limited and have to be struggled for, Soloveitchik is a Lutheran, right? And Heschel is very much a Catholic. That is, a world suffused with the presence of God, and my very inner life is already connected to God in an unbreakable way. There is something to that distinction, even if both of them would find it.
What? Wait, you said Soloveitchik finds God in Heschel?
No. Soloveitchik is a Lutheran in the sense of God who has been largely kicked upstairs, and the human being is thrown in the world looking for a connection to God that is not obvious and manifest at all moments. Heschel is a Catholic in the sense that he thinks the whole world points to God, but also the whole world is suffused with the presence of God, and even my very self, you know, as he says, we never have to discover God only to recover God. So, you know, okay. For those of you interested in this kind of thing, it's no secret that Soloveitchik spent a lot of time reading people like Karl Barth and Emil Gruner and lots of 20th century Protestant theologians who deeply influenced the way he thought about the world. Okay. How many people have the Halachic Man packet with them? Fascinating. You know, you make a request and they blow it. Okay. So I'm just going to say one thing about that last page. We won't read it together. I just want to point it to your attention. Because of how we used our time, we did not really in this essay, I'm sorry, in this summer session, really get to develop the really heavy counterweight that will emerge in Soloveitchik as he gets older, which is a preoccupation with two things. Number one, surrender, submission, although he gestures towards that at the end of the essay on redemption and prayer, where he talks about you acquire a self in order to give it up, right? But, so one, the preoccupation with surrender, submission, sacrifice, and two, the preoccupation with the idea that Jewish spirituality is filled with these unresolvable antinomies, or as he puts it in this essay that you have in front of me, dialectics without synthesis. Right? Now, dialectics without synthesis, just to be clear on what that means, right? I think I might have mentioned this on the very first Sunday of the summer, right? So, Hegel's famous understanding of what a dialectic is, right? You have a thesis, an antithesis, and then ultimately, you have a synthesis. Soloveitchik's understanding of what a Jewish dialectic is, you have a thesis, you have an antithesis, and good luck to you. Right? In other words, and now live with them. And the synthesis, if there is one, is actually living with the complexity of holding two poles as true at the same time. So the example he gives in this essay that you have before you, Majesty and Humility, it's not the example that most of us would most quickly think of. It's actually the example, and you don't have the essay, although I'm always happy to give it to people who want it. The example he gives is that human beings are both totally drawn to having a place they call home and almost ineluctably, unstoppably drawn to exploring new vistas of the world. And that there's ultimately, he's not saying there aren't individuals who sort of are one or the other, but as a rule, there's no answer to that. There's no, okay, so you should travel sometimes but live at home. That's not the point is he's talking about deep, sort of ontological pulls that lie at the core of our being. We both want to explore the world, and we both want to live in a very concrete place. He thinks, in great Soloveitchik drasha form, that's what Breishit Rabbah means when it says that Adam was created from the afar of all four corners of the earth. It means that on some level there is no home. He's constantly looking for foreign, for new. And at the same time, right, he's in one place. Now, you know, I have suggested, you know, many times, I've probably said it to you guys too, the really dramatic example of this that I think is most powerful experientially is, right, the thesis is, Bishvili Nivra Olam, right, I am infinitely valuable, and the antithesis is, Anokhi Afar Vaifer, I am nothing, and the synthesis, which is unavailable to us, is,
okay, so I'm somewhat valuable, right? No, right? The only synthesis, quote-unquote, is the ability to live with the two truths at the same time. I am infinitely valuable and a speck of nothing. And that's what Soloveitchik is gesturing towards here as the heart of Jewish spirituality theology, but more importantly, I think, for him, spirituality, right? That what it means is to live with this antinomy. Now, where this gets extremely compelling for some people and somewhat problematic or even repellent for others is he has the temptation sometimes to melodramatize that, right? So that there's a kind of like torment that is constitutive of what it means to be a human being. What it means to be alive is to have these pulls that are unresolvable. Yeah, you'll see.
It's interesting that Eastern philosophers don't have any problem with these sorts of paradoxes. The angst only comes when you're working, when you're starting from the assumption of Hegel, where you have these thesis and synthesis that require antithesis that require synthesis. If you start from a different set of assumptions, and there's an angst.
Yeah, okay, I mean, right, that's, you've just opened the possibility of a really interesting cross-cultural conversation that at this late moment with 17 minutes left in the summer, I can't quite take on, but that it is a really interesting point, and in that sense, we'll just say he is very much in a tradition that you might even say, and I'm happy to give you references for this, valorizes angst, which is not unproblematic. There's a lot more to say about that, but okay. Now, the other thing that emerges in this dialectic that I just want to sort of put out there is that when Soloveitchik, in a way, you know, one of the problems that a lot of people who allow themselves in a way to sort of engage Halachic Man a little bit from a distance, emerges is that Book 2 of Halachic Man is so preoccupied with creativity that it almost doesn't seem to leave space for, well, what about all the ways that I actually can't exercise agency? What about the ways where life demands surrender? What about the illness that can't be cured? What about the, you know, the death that can't be revoked? What about, you know, the war that can't be undone? And there is a way in which, as Soloveitchik matures, the need to balance a preoccupation with agency and creativity, sort of that need gets stronger for him, and you see a preoccupation with surrender, or a dialectic between sort of agency and surrender. What I think is sort of interesting to me, somewhat problematic about Soloveitchik in this way, is that for him, the dominant mode of surrender that he's interested in is surrender of obedience to the law, which, just to be clear, I'm not suggesting doesn't belong in a Jewish theology, but it's interesting how that becomes so much the concern that surrender in some deeper sort of existential way gets dramatically underplayed. Now, if you asked him this question, he might say that the reason why, one of you, I had this conversation with someone not so long ago, One of the ways in which we prepare ourselves for ultimate surrender is by surrendering to the law. But nevertheless, the dominant preoccupation here is the surrender of giving up my agency. Or again, as I said, you know, he makes this claim, right? The heart of Judaism becomes, he says, hakrevet korbancha.
Isn't that tefillah? Like, isn't that his whole prayer?
That's one essay on tefillah, a late essay on tefillah, where he thinks that's what the Amidah is. Right. That's already late. Yet, remember, when you think about Soloveitchik, okay, so Chana makes me want to point out one thing to you. Do not assume, based on this essay, that you now are ready to talk about Soloveitchik on tefillah. Because remember what I said at the beginning about how, especially for Soloveitchik, right, different essays paint from different perspectives. And nowhere is that more true than on his essays on tefillah. In the essay, very long and important and, I think, deeply problematic essay on tefillah called Rayonot al HaTefillah, The dominant mode of tefillah is surrender to a traditional liturgy, which is different, to say the least, from what liturgy does here. I'm just sort of saying that to sort of keep that in mind, because it's, on the one hand, the notion of surrender is important and is developed in interesting ways. On the other hand, he seems at times to develop it in a kind of monochromal way, right? Where it's about submission to the law without explicitly talking about the ways that submission or surrender might be kind of a broader human existential category, at least in the essays I'm thinking of. We'll see what happens as more and more stuff comes out. So maybe as a way, before we run out of time, you know, when we were about to end Heschel, I gave you this list of sort of themes that I thought were worth thinking about and remembering. I want to do something similar for Soloveitchik, but in an incredibly truncated, abbreviated way. I just want to, in a way, follow in five steps the logic of why we read what we did in the order that we did. And I'll say this very quickly, and this is really just, there's no one who, if you've been sitting here, couldn't do this themselves, but I just want to do it for a second anyway. Right? The first step we saw is the preoccupation with human creativity, or what I tried more expansively to say, human agency. Right? And the suggestion that that is the highest form of the halakhta bidrachav. The highest form of imitatio Dei, of walking in God's ways, is just as God is a creator, mahu yotzer afata. Okay? The second piece is the intertwining of creation of worlds and creation of self. And that is the understanding of tshuva as a subcategory of yetzirah. Right? Repentance, return, however you want to understand what tshuva, how tshuva should be translated, is a subcategory of the more fundamental human project of becoming a creator. Part of what it means to create a world is to create a self. And as a footnote, a discussion that's always worth thinking about is what is the relationship in our own worldview and our own experience between trying to build worlds and trying to sculpt a self? How do those two things relate to each other? How do they play out in our day-to-day life? Okay, so that's an important second piece. Now, the little piece we read from that book, Reflections of the Rav, takes it in a particular direction and says, in a way, you know what the highest of the high is? Not just creating, but creating in the face of destruction and devastation. Right? And that becomes, I think, among other things, Soloveitchik's prescription for rebuilding Jewish life, and in his case, particularly, the life of Torah learning after the Shoah. So we have creation in general, creation of worlds, creation of self, and then a particular sort of emphasis on creation after facing devastation. Then we move to the essay of Shlichut, which I thought was a kind of natural next step because it sort of individualizes the mandate to agency. Right? It basically says, not just am I asked to create in general, but I'm asked to create in particular. Not just am I asked to sort of be an Eved Hashem, right, in some generic way, but as a particular individual. And there, as in everywhere, we talked about the interesting question of which claims in Soloveitchik are intended to be metaphysics, and which claims in Soloveitchik are intended only to be sort of an animating narrative of our life without necessarily making claims about the cosmic truth of that. That's a question. That's a question that Soloveitchik scholars debate. And then finally, today, I wanted, or Friday and today, to sort of, bless you, enrich this conversation by looking at a particular essay of Soloveitchik's where, in a way, I acquire a self through speech, through the act of speaking. And there, the categories of creation and redemption become totally intertwined. I almost want to say, I'm not sure this is language you would like, that in this essay, the very act of creating a self is an act of redemption. Yetzirah and Geulah here are like almost overlapping categories. The act of becoming a Yotzer through speech is the act of being Nigal. Reminds me, by the way, that I
forgot who said this. Some, was it Shlomo Maimon? Someone makes the comment in the early scholarship about Chassidut that the way to understand the spiritual project of Chassidut is every man his own Messiah. Every person is responsible on some level for redeeming him or herself. Whether that's a good reading of Chassidut, I'm not totally sure. It's interesting, but it was for a while a very influential take. And there's a way in which this essay is a version of every man his own Messiah. If you... Right, exactly. But, exactly. Okay. All right. So that's just a little sort of just where we've come in the salvation trajectory. And where we would have gone, right, and the next step is the sort of the balancing of this preoccupation with creativity and agency with surrender, limitation, halakha, not just as about creativity, but halakha also as mode of encouraging surrender. And then had we had more time, we would have engaged some critical essays on whether Soloveitchik, in learning to balance his early self, ends up overbalancing on the other, in the other direction. Okay, now I want to just sort of, in a way, end by just saying a couple of things about the study of Agadah in general. And there's a lot that I would love to say, but I only have like 4 minutes. So I want to share two images with you from Heschel's book, Torah Min HaShamayim, and then just take a second to read one line from Sifrei Dvarim. Heschel makes a comment that I think is actually kind of interesting, and to be honest, I never really paid attention to it until this morning, which is when he says, "Ha'agadah me'ein tefilahi." Agadah is a form of prayer. And I think part of what he has in mind here is that Agadah, and here I am somewhat, in a way I would have to defend, using Agadah and theology as synonyms. Agadah I'm using as a category that will incorporate theology, although also include non-explicitly theological stuff. His argument is that Agadah should not be seen as some kind of academic exercise where one just sort of engages philosophical ideas, but where one is trying to figure out what the truth is so one can figure out what claims the truth makes on me. And it's about, to use a term that at some point I hope to be able to try to write what I mean by this, because I'm not sure anybody but me knows, and I'm not even sure that I know, but it's about a mode of prayerfulness, right, which is not about necessarily specific moments of prayer, but rather a way of being in the world that is about, to use Heschel's language, making space for God in the world. And Agadah, on some level, I think he's intimating, is about sort of asking theological questions that are ultimately aimed at making space for God in the world. And the danger, as he more eloquently than anyone else, I think, in the 20th century made clear, is that if you have an agadah, if you have a halakha without an agadah, all you end up with is a whole pile of nothing in particular. Right? A whole bunch of details that have no aspiration to them, that have no animating narrative behind them, that have no cause. He derisively calls that pan-halachism, the notion that all of Judaism is basically halakha. Or he also calls it religious behaviorism, the notion, right, that Judaism is interested in what you do, and what you think or feel is totally uninterested. The claim of Agadah me'in tefilahi is yet one more articulation for him of why without Agadah there is no Torah. Right? Without Agadah there is no Torah, and for that matter, without Agadah there's no halakha that's recognizable as halakha. There's just a list. Okay. Now, he also says this thing that I think is kind of striking, and in a way, maybe I'm just being autobiographical for a moment, but he points out this thing, this throwaway comment. He says, the Tanaim, as a rule, when they talk about Torah, ooh, I can't remember now when he's talking about Torah or Agadah specifically, think it's Agadah. He says the Tanaim refer to Torah as Yayin. But the Amoraim, almost to a head, refer to Torah as Mayim. Right? So in the earlier rabbinic tradition, Agadot get called wine, and in the later rabbinic tradition, Agadot get called water. And Heschel, you know, as only someone who basically knows the entire corpus of rabbinic literature can do, says, how do I explain this? And he quotes totally out of context this line from the Yerushalmi, Efshar la'olam b'lo yayin v'efshar lo b'lo mayim. Right? The world can exist without wine, but the world cannot exist without water. In other words, the suggestion is that the reason why Chazal begin to talk about Agadah as mayim and not yayin is because they're trying to find a way to say, this is not like dessert. This is not fun stuff when you're too tired to learn halakha, but this is the stuff without which there is no life for Torah or what's called it, Judaicness, right? You can't actually take Torah, you can't actually take life in a spiritual way seriously as a Jew without taking this stuff as lifeblood in some fundamental way. And in a way, by the way, I would say, like, if I had maybe a presumptuous bracha for people, is that we have moments in our life where we experience what it means to feel like my hunger for Torah is like my hunger for water. It reminds me, by the way, sorry for 1 minute, you know, the verse, Sam'a nafshi le'elohim, right? My, usually rendered in English as my soul thirsts for God. It's a terrible translation because if you do a little bit of scholarship on biblical Hebrew, you may know that the word nefesh in the Bible definitely does not mean soul. Right? In Chazal, nefesh already comes to mean soul. But nefesh, in biblical Hebrew, means life, the full life, but it derives from the word for gullet, or throat, which was understood as sort of the seat of life. If you don't know why they might think that, walk up to someone, don't actually do this, but walk up to someone like this, right? You could kill them, right? Very easily. One shot to the throat. It's a seat of life. And what occurred to me not so long ago is that the verse Sam'a nafshi le'elohim is amazing because it's actually the claim my throat is parched for God, which is a much more like visceral, physical image than my soul thirsts for God. It's nice. I don't exactly know what it means, but it's nice. My throat is parched for God is like this incredibly, like almost bodily need for God and Torah. Primarily in that episode, obviously, for God. Okay. Now, last thing I just want to say is there's a line that is very well known, but I think we often don't spend enough time thinking about it. It's Sifrei Dvarim. I'm on the third line of this page. Sifrei is the Tanaitic Midrash on Sefer Dvarim. And it says the following, I think, quite striking thing. Dorshei Hagadot Omrim, Ritzoncha Lahakir Et Misha Amar Vaya Olam. So these interpreters say, is it your desire to know the one who spoke and the world came into being? And here it's important, the language is lahakir, which is a language of relationality rather than sort of abstract cognitive knowledge. Is it your desire to know, in the sense of relationship, the one who spoke and the world came into being? If so, limod hagadah, limod agadah, study agadah theology, Shemitoch kach, because through this, atamakir et misha amar vayaola, because through this, you come to know the one who spoke and the world came into being. I'm stopping there for a second to point out one thing, which is that the purpose of studying theology is not to know theology, but to know God. I just sort of want to emphasize that the goal is not to have bekias in the history of theology. The goal is actually for theology to direct us not to da'at, but to lehakir. The goal of theology is to know God. But the end of this midrash is kind of, it's astonishing in a lot of ways, because the logic is amazing. Someone comes and says, Ritzoni lehakir et mishamar vaya olam. I want to know God. And the midrash answers, good, lemod agadah. Study Agadah, because through that you come to know the one who spoke the world into being. And then it adds, although nobody asked, Umidabek Bidrachav. And what is Umidabek Bidrachav, as I've mentioned a few times this summer for Chazal? It's always the life of Chesed. So the claim here is amazing, right? You want to know God? Okay, study Agadah, because through it you'll come to know God and become a creature of Chesed. Now, one way to read this is in a kind of almost triumphalistic way that says, oh, if I just study Agadah, I'll end up being a Baal Chesed. The claim here, I think, is actually incredibly profound, which is, if I study Agadah the right way, with heart, mind, and soul, and I actually come to know God, I will realize that there is no such thing as knowing God that doesn't spill over into my relationship with people in their vulnerability. There's no way for that to be real. And if it doesn't, then in some way I have not yet learned Torah. If I do not grow in Chesed, and I just sort of in a way want to say that as a, and this is as much addressed to me as to anybody else, it's very easy in the world of Torah learning and traditional observance and all this other important stuff to sort of lose track of the ultimate spiritual height and in some ways the most easy and in some ways the most difficult piece of all this, which is that all of it in the end leads to being a creature of Chesed, or it hasn't really gotten off the ground yet. And I say that because I think it's important to avoid the temptation to learn Torah in a way in which all it is interesting. To my mind, that's Jewish studies. Like, that's interesting. But it's not Torah until it manifests as Chesed. That is a implicit bracha, an implicit challenge, and like my deepest aspiration for what the Torah of Yeshivat Hadar and all the people who ever come through its doors, that we all know and strive to embody that notion that through learning Torah in general and Haggadah in particular, we come to embody Chesed. So as the last part of this class, I would like to say Kaddish Derabanan, and then we will go up to Mincha.
Yehi shlama rabba mishmai havachayim aleinu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru amein. Hose shalom v'imru mav, hu yaseh shalom aleinu v'al kol Yisrael v'imru amein.
Amen.